Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Katie Weaver. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a new report says Russia's use of arrests, long jail terms, and pressure on activists appears to be having little effect on anti-government protests. In the first 6 months of 2019, there were 863 protests nationwide, the report said. By the end of the year, the total will probably be more than 2,000. Most of the demonstrations are against the government and law enforcement agencies or organized to protest environmental damage or cuts in government aid. There are fewer and fewer regions that aren't reporting protests, says Anna Oshkina, who wrote the report. She works for the Center for Social and Labor Rights, a Moscow-based non-governmental organization. The anti-government protests have yet to affect two parts of the country: Chukotka, a mostly roadless area of northeastern Russia, and Chechnya, which has been under the rule of Ramzan Kadyrov since 2005. Rights groups have accused his militias of kidnappings and killings. The new study looked only at the first 6 months of 2019. It did not examine any of the large anti-government protests that have taken place since last July. Tens of thousands of protesters have been holding regular rallies in Moscow to protest reports of cheating in city council elections. These Moscow rallies have fueled campaigns of support in other communities. So far, a few of the nearly 3,000 of those arrested in Moscow have received jail time. But over 20 others remain in detention and face long prison sentences on charges of mass rioting. The report says the protesters are mainly worried about political issues. It says this is different from the first 3 months of the year, when two of the main issues were an increase in the retirement age and poor public services. Political concerns were the main issues in 130 of the 434 protests from April to the end of June. The Russian government appears unable to stop the protest movement from growing. It is the most serious test for the government since the Bolotnaya rallies of late 2011 and 2012. In those protests, activists called on President Vladimir Putin to leave office. Young people and student activists seem to be the leading force in many of the recent protests. They are using messaging apps like Telegram to organize protests, as well as to send information about arrests and legal needs, notes sociologist Olga Zavaleva. She said the new protests are being shaped by generational politics as well as new forms of technology. Her comments appeared on the Masuza news website. The human rights project OVD Info monitors arrests across the country. It then sends a Telegram message that offers legal expertise to people who have been arrested. An independent student magazine has set up a Telegram group to discuss ways to plan protests. It also organizes efforts to raise money to pay fines. Zavaleva adds that students who have been arrested also can get help from the magazine. Activists fear the protests could simply end as they did in 2012 when the government pushed hard against the protesters. On Friday, a court in the Russian city of Rostov-on-Don sentenced two young activists to more than 6 years in prison on charges of attempting to organize mass unrest. The two were arrested near a government building in the city in November of 2017. They had been holding up signs calling for Putin's resignation. Police have been holding the activists since their arrests. Amnesty International describes them as prisoners of conscience. Denis Krivosheyev is Amnesty's deputy director for Eastern Europe and Central Asia. He calls the jail sentence deplorable. Anti-government activists worry that they are failing to bring the larger middle class into the fight against Russia's leadership. Andrei Kolesnikov is a Russia expert with the Carnegie Moscow Center. He says the protests show a divide in the middle class between those who are dependent on state jobs and those who earn their money in the market economy.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Taking a long, deep breath is good for both our bodies and minds. It supplies necessary oxygen to our blood and can help to create emotional calm. However, calm and oxygen are not the only things a deep breath brings. In many parts of the world, a deep breath also brings pollutants into our bodies. For many people around the world, breathing polluted air has become the new normal. On its website, the World Health Organization warns that 91% of the world's population lives in places where air quality exceeds WHO guideline limits. WHO experts estimate that each year air pollution kills about 7 million people around the world. It says about 4.2 million deaths are linked to outdoor air pollution and about 3.8 million are linked to inside air pollution. The WHO adds that air pollution harms billions more. Perhaps not surprisingly, cities are especially bad. Over 80% of people who live in urban areas, the WHO reports, are breathing levels of air pollution that are unhealthy.
Researchers often study individual chemicals and toxins found in air pollution. However, some studies now show that it is the size of pollutants in the air that is most threatening to health. Fine particulate matter that is 2.5 micrometer in diameter or smaller seems to do the most damage. That size is about 3% the size of a human hair, or smaller. Scientists often call this kind of air pollution PM2.5 for short. The smallest PM can move through tissue. Because we breathe in air pollution, we may think that it only affects the human breathing system. But research shows that the mouth, nose, throat, and lungs are not the only body parts affected by air pollution. Many in the scientific community say that PM2.5 can affect every organ and every cell in our body. Researchers have found that PM2.5 can even pass through the barrier that protects our brains. It can also reach the placenta. So even in the womb, a fetus is not safe from air pollution.
The heart and blood system is also affected. The WHO reports that air pollution causes 24% of deaths from brain attacks called strokes. The UN agency adds that 25% of all heart disease is from air pollution. Scientists with the Forum of International Respiratory Societies, or FIRS, study the damage air pollution does to our bodies. They warn that air pollution affects many systems in the body and is a great risk to health. Earlier this year, the FIRS Environmental Committee published two reports in the February 2019 American College of Chest Physicians. They detail the effects of air pollution on health and evidence for its link to many diseases. Dr. Dean Schroffnagel was the lead investigator. Following the publication of the reports, he said, "It is well known that air pollution is a major contributor to lung disease, but this review also shows how it can damage most other organ systems of the body."
The FIRS researchers also found air pollution to be harmful to the aging brain. They reported that older adults with heavy exposure to air pollution performed poorly on tests of brain operations. They said this group showed an increased risk of dementia compared to adults with less exposure. The reports add that air pollution weakens bones, so they break more easily. Air pollution also ages our skin, hurts our eyes, and interferes with sleep. It affects the kidneys. And the researchers said living near busy roadways might lead to liver disease.
Researchers at the WHO say that in 2016, about 600,000 children under the age of 5 died from disease linked to air pollution. Indoor cooking plays a part, as some families use unsafe fuels for cooking and keeping warm. Experts at the WHO say that there are 3.8 million deaths every year as a result of household exposure to smoke from dirty cook stoves and fuels. Experts say governments need to take the lead in fighting air pollution health risks. Dr. Schroffnagel adds that the best way to reduce exposure to air pollution is to control it at its source. He explains that governments need to do this by setting pollution standards and regulatory processes. He and other experts suggest that individuals reduce their exposure by avoiding areas with polluted air and staying indoors when outdoor air pollution levels are high. And they say to wear face masks. These cloth or paper covers for the nose and mouth can block many air pollutants from entering the body. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Thank you. From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. James Madison of Virginia was elected President of the United States in 1808. He was inaugurated in Washington on March 4, 1809. The people of the city were happy with the new president, but the nation was not yet sure what kind of leader he would be. Madison's first 4 years were not easy. He had to deal with a foreign policy problem that the former president, Thomas Jefferson, was not able to solve: increasingly tense relations with Britain. Historian Alan Taylor has written several books on early American history and has won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing. He says Madison took office under difficult circumstances.
Jefferson, in many ways, was a tough act to follow because he'd been extraordinarily popular. But he had made one great policy mistake with Madison's support. Madison had been his Secretary of State. And that mistake was something known as the embargo.
The embargo had arisen from a war between Britain and France. The two nations refused to honor America's neutrality. Each tried to prevent the United States from trading with the other. Both interfered with American shipping, and the British Navy sometimes seized American sailors. President Jefferson ordered a ban on trade with Europe, but the embargo failed to end the hostile acts against the United States. A month after Madison took office, the British minister in Washington, David Erskine, said Britain would stop seizing American ships if the United States would trade again with Britain. But Erskine did not make clear that the British government demanded several conditions. One condition was that the United States continue the ban against trade with France. Another was that Britain be permitted to capture American ships that violated the law. President Madison did not accept these conditions, but he still believed he had reached an agreement with the British minister. He announced that the United States would reopen trade with Britain. Hundreds of ships left American ports. But a few weeks later, Madison received surprising news. The British government had rejected the agreement he reached with Erskine. Letters were exchanged, but Madison could not get a good explanation for what had happened. He finally broke off all communications, and Erskine and his replacement left Washington. America's policy of trade with Britain and France continued to be a serious issue. President Madison approved trade with all countries in 1810. But when relations with Britain did not improve, he stopped trade with the country again in the spring of 1811. Trade was not the only problem, however. A growing number of Americans believed that the British were helping some Native Americans to fight the United States. As the people of the United States began to move to the northern and western territories, the government made treaties with the different Indian tribes. The treaties explained which land belonged to the Indians and which land could be settled by white people. The settlers did not always honor the treaties. Historian Alan Taylor explains that Indian tribes were trying to defend their homelands. He says they asked the British to provide them with guns and ammunition to fight against the American settlements.
And the British were playing a very ambivalent game. In other words, they wanted to keep the Indians on a kind of retainer. In the eventuality that war did happen, they would want to mobilize those Indians. So they did provide them with guns and ammunition, but they hoped that the native peoples would just use them on the defensive.
A leader of the Shawnee Indian tribe, Tecumseh, decided to unite all Indians and help them defend against the settlers. Throughout the West, many Americans believed that the British in Canada were responsible for Tecumseh's efforts. They demanded war with Britain to destroy the power of the tribes. In Washington, a new Congress was meeting. Some of the new members were very different from the men who had controlled Congress before. They were less willing to compromise and more willing to defend America's interests. They soon got the name War Hawks. At the same time, America had a new Secretary of State. Madison chose his close friend, James Monroe. What the United States did not have at that troubled time was a representative in Britain. The British minister in Washington, Francis James Jackson, returned to London when Madison broke off communications. The American minister in London, William Pinckney, sailed home as well. There was no official in either capital to report what was happening. And in the spring of 1812, the United States and Britain were moving closer to war. President Madison had hoped for some sign of compromise, but he was sure there would be war. He had seen the instructions from London to Britain's new minister in Washington, Augustus Foster. The foreign minister warned Foster to say nothing about any compromise. He wanted the United States to see how firmly Britain would stand against neutral trade with its enemies. Also, historian Alan Taylor says, the United States did not believe Britain would stop inspecting American ships and taking away any sailors the British thought were British subjects.
And because the British would not change that policy, and the United States was determined to try to force them to change that policy, that's why the war happened.
In the United States, Congress continued to prepare the nation for war. Lawmakers voted to increase the size of the army and to borrow money to pay for things the larger army would need. But not all lawmakers wanted war with Britain. Many Federalists especially opposed it. Congressman Hermanus Bleeker showed the House a list of hundreds of names from his area of New York. He said all these people opposed the embargo and the idea of war with Britain. It is impossible, he said, that we can go to war when the embargo ends 60 days from now. Where are our armies, our navy? Have we the money to fight a war? Why, it would be treason to go to war this soon, so poorly prepared. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin was having a difficult time finding money to borrow. He could get almost no money at all from Federalist bankers in the New England states in the Northeast. Congress had approved borrowing $11 million. But Gallatin found the banks would lend only $6 million to the federal government. The Federalists charged that Gallatin's difficulties showed that the people did not want war, especially the people of New England. If the people of the West and the South wanted to fight, then let them pay for the war. Yet, sure that Britain would not change its hostile policies, President Madison sent a secret message to Congress on June 1st, proposing that war be declared. Madison listed the reasons for war. British warships had violated the American flag at sea. The British Navy had seized and carried off persons protected by the flag. British warships also violated United States waters, interfering with American ships as they entered and left port. Another reason, he said, was Britain's orders against trade with France or allies of France. International law, he said, gave Britain no right to make such orders. Madison also spoke of the hostile Indians of the Northwest Territory and seemed to charge British Canada with helping the Indians. The president's message went to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives for discussion. The final vote in the House on declaring war was 79-4 and 49 against. In the Senate, the vote was closer, 19-4 and 13 against. President Madison signed the bill into law on June 18th. The War of 1812 had begun. The leaders in Washington did not know it, but 2 days earlier, Britain had ended its orders against neutral American trade. The orders might have been withdrawn earlier, except for a number of events. British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, under great political pressure, had decided to end the British orders on neutral trade. Businesses and traders were loudly protesting that the orders were destroying England's economy. On May 11th, before Perceval could act, he was shot to death. Not until June 8th was agreement reached on a new Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool. 8 days later, his government announced that the orders were ended immediately. This was only 2 days before war was to be declared in Washington, and with ships being the only method of communication, the British action was not learned of in time. If the United States had had a minister in London during the spring of 1812, the diplomat would have been able to report progress toward ending the orders. But the American minister, William Pinckney, had returned home a year earlier.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.